Good morning, may it please the court. My name is Adam Newland. I'm a public defender and I represent Antonio Hasso. My attorney registration number is 42176. Although the opening brief addresses a number of errors by the trial court, in the limited time I have today, I plan to discuss the first issue in the brief, which is the trial court's refusal to submit the domestic violence finding to the jury. Now, to start, I want to highlight an area where the Attorney General and I agree, so I can narrow the focus of the discussion to, I think, the two areas where there's disagreement. The Attorney General and I agree that, as a matter of Colorado law, absent a factual finding that Mr. Hasso committed an act of domestic violence, the trial court was powerless to convict him of a felony and sentence him to DOC. Where we disagree is which entity was entitled to make that finding, the jury or the judge, and assuming there was error, whether the error was structural or subject to a harm analysis. Now, it's my position that this point of agreement is actually dispositive of the case, because the Sixth Amendment requires a jury finding on all facts that are essential to punishment.
Well, Mr. Mueller, here's what I'm interested in hearing. Why do you believe that the domestic violence conduct was not fairly reflected in the verdict of the jury?
I think that's true if you look at the elements of the protection order violation. All the jury had to find in order to convict Mr. Hasso of violating the protection order was that he knowingly contacted the protected party after being served with the protection. And in this case, the state's allegation was that he sent the letter and the poem in violation of the protection order, and that was contact.
But isn't the protection order itself fairly reflected in the jury's verdict? It's part of the evidence.
Well, the protection order is in itself, but contact in violation of the protection order is not necessarily domestic violence. It's not necessarily coercion or control in violation of the domestic violence statute.
But don't we have a situation here where there's no question about the intimate relationship?
Yes, we did not dispute that there was an intimate relationship in the past.
And no question that there was a violation of the order. And the letter itself, couldn't the jury fairly determine that it was coercive? So that even though the jury verdict doesn't plainly state that it's domestic violence, nevertheless, what they found of necessity reflects a domestic violence violation.
I disagree, Your Honor. I think in this case, all the jury had to determine was that there was contact. And it's my position that contact does not necessarily equal coercion or control. In fact, we disputed whether the protection order was violated, but I recognize the evidence of that is not necessarily in our favor. But we did make a powerful, I think, sufficiency argument on the domestic violence finding, which is the second issue in the brief, which I hadn't necessarily planned on talking about, but it's a separate and distinct issue. And I would like to actually point out the words you used here in your question, Judge Graham. You said, couldn't the jury determine? The jury could have determined if you assume the evidence was sufficient, but the jury wasn't asked to determine. Just by finding that my client sent a letter in violation of the protection order does not necessarily mean that he meant the letter to coerce or control the protected party. And in this case, the letter, I think fairly read, doesn't support finding that there was coercion or control, but assuming this court disagrees, that's a jury question, and there's absolutely a genuine dispute about that in this case. And by finding that my client sent the letter, the jury did not determine as a factual matter that the letter was intended to coerce or control the protected part.
Mr. Mueller, let me just follow up with that then. So if I'm understanding what you're saying is what is reflected in a jury verdict is not necessarily underlying facts, but just the elements of the crime, or what is
the
distinction?
The distinction here is, in this case, the jury verdict only represents that my client contacted the protected party in violation of the protection order. The protection order said no contact, except as it related to the son, in this case, via text messages, and my client sent a letter. That's all the jury verdict reflects as a factual matter. There's no jury determination that the content of the letter meant was intended to force or control the protected party in this case. And that's a separate and distinct question from whether he contacted the protected party. And I just gave an example in this case. If they were passing each other on the street and my client said, hello, that would be a violation of the protection. commissioner under literal terms of the statute. But I don't think there'd be any argument that that was intended to coerce or control. I apologize, I'm not sure where that sounds coming from.
Mr. Mueller, I'm very sorry.
No problem.
I'd ask the bailiff to find out, if possible, what's going on with the...
I don't have my phone for me. If the court pleases, I'll move on.
Please do, sir.
Unless you would like to take...
You can just turn it on. My colleagues, you can turn your volume down.
Yeah, turn my volume.
There we go. Ah!
It's coming from yours now.
Excuse me, Mr. Mueller.
No problem about that.
Okay. Let's give Mr. Mueller an extra minute so that...
I think they stopped the clock, actually, Your Honor.
Wonderful.
Okay.
All right.
Good feeling.
We're back on track.
Okay, thanks. So moving back to my position here, the Sixth Amendment requires a jury finding on all facts that are essential to the punishment. And in this case, absent a factual finding of domestic violence, my client was guilty of nothing more than a Class 1 extraordinary risk misdemeanor. It was only with the benefit of that finding that the court could have convicted him of a Class 5 felony and sentenced him to DOC. And I think under that logic, a violation of the Sixth Amendment is apparent. As to whether this error is structural or harmless, I think the Supreme Court's case in Medina fairly resolves that question. As I said, at most, the jury verdict reflects a conviction on a Class 1 misdemeanor. And yet the court, acting without a jury finding, imposed a conviction for a felony and sentenced my client to 30 months in the Department of Corrections. And that's a structural error, because the court imposed a conviction and sentence that was not authorized by the jury verdict. And in my view, that's indistinguishable from Medina, where the jury verdict reflected, at most, a Class 5 felony conviction, and the court sentenced the defendant for a Class 4 felony conviction and imposed a sentence accordingly.
Mr. Mueller, let me ask you, does that conflict with other cases decided by our Colorado Supreme Court, which say that Blakely Apprendi error is amenable to a harm analysis?
No, it does not, Your Honor. I think it depends upon the context in which the Blakely error occurs. If a Blakely error exists in a situation where it doesn't change the applicable, it doesn't change the class of the felony or the underlying crime itself, then it could be amenable to structural error or to harmless error analysis, because you can actually determine what effect the error had on the jury verdict that exists. In this case, you can't do that. You'd be purely speculating as to what the jury would have decided had it been properly instructed. So let me give an example. I think the most analogous situation might be theft from an at-risk adult or assault of an at-risk adult, which would be ordinarily a misdemeanor, but you have an at-risk adult finding, which is a factual question that's routinely put to the jury, and with the benefit of that finding, it becomes a felony. Absent that finding, the client's guilty of nothing more than a misdemeanor, and to sentence the client to the Department of Corrections and impose a felony conviction is not consistent with the Constitution. I don't think is amenable to a harm analysis, because it would be an appellate court speculating as to what a properly instructed jury would have done. And so the alternate case might be a decision from this court in Goldfuss, for example, which is also a domestic violence case, where there was a domestic violence finding made by the court. And that was not a violation of the Sixth Amendment, and if it had been, it probably would have been harmless, because all that did in that case was empower the court to impose probation conditions that the court already had the power to do in any case. And so it didn't broaden the court's authority beyond what it could have done on the basis of the jury verdict alone. Now I'd like to talk just briefly about the Attorney General's principal argument in response to the error here, to what I contend is the error here. The Attorney General's response is that there was no Sixth Amendment violation because the domestic violence finding alone did not expose my client to the F5 conviction. It was that finding combined with the prior convictions. I don't think that's a correct understanding of the Sixth Amendment. And the principal reason why is this. The prior convictions, if you take the factual finding of domestic violence out of the equation, don't empower the court to do anything in this case beyond imposing Class 1 misdemeanor. The factual finding was necessary to turn this case into a felony from what otherwise would have been a misdemeanor. And so the finding of domestic violence was essential to the punishment, as that term is used by the Supreme Court in Blakely and Apprendi cases that follow. I've covered what I intended to do at the beginning. If there are any other questions, I reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Well, let me ask you a follow-up question on your last point, because the state relies on a Washington case which finds just the opposite.
Yes.
So I would like you to deconstruct what Washington did and why would that would not work.
Yeah. I read that case, frankly, I read that case a number of times, and I didn't entirely understand it, to be honest. I think a lot of it might have had to do with the fact that I believe it's a 2004 decision and might have just followed the court's decision in Blakely. I could be wrong about the date there. In Washington at the time, Blakely was a case out of Washington, and I think their statutes that were at issue in that case operate differently than ours. If it actually stands for the proposition that the court for which the Attorney General cited it, then I think it's not reconcilable with Apprendi, and I would just argue that it's incorrectly decided and this court should not follow it.
All right, well, let me ask another follow-up with that. So if a fact is essential for increased punishment, is it just a, let me put it this way, is it the sole fact that would be responsible, and is this one of those cases, or are you saying that any fact in the mix, say if there's two or three facts that together would require enhanced sentencing?
I think any fact that is essential to the punishment must be submitted to the jury and proved beyond a reasonable doubt. In the wake of the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Alleyn from last term, any fact that increases the punishment and is essential to the punishment is an element. That's what Justice Thomas says in that case. So if you have three facts and all three are necessary to imposing an enhanced punishment, then yes, all three have to be proved to the jury. But if only two are necessary, then one could be taken away. So for example here, I'm willing to assume for the sake of argument that the prior conviction exception is correct, and the jury did not have to determine that my client had three prior domestic violence convictions. And if that's true, those facts are necessary as well in this case to the punishment. Absent those prior convictions, he wouldn't have been guilty of a felony either. So I will assume for the moment that there's that exception. But if that exception didn't exist, I would argue that that had to be submitted to the jury to prove beyond a reasonable doubt as well, because it's the prior convictions and the domestic violence finding that turned what was otherwise a misdemeanor into a felony.
Thank you,
Mr. Mueller. We have about 4.5 minutes remaining. Ms. Moreleta.
May it please the court. Carmen Moreleta, on behalf of the people, my attorney registration number is 34852.
Ms. Moreleta, before you begin, and excuse me for just jumping in here, but I'm curious, should I read the people's answer brief here as a concession that what the trial court did below was, in fact, engage in fact-finding?
Well, to some extent it was, because even though I guess the ultimate decision whether something is domestic violence might be a legal determination, necessarily some facts, the court must engage in some factual finding. Was there a relationship?
If the domestic violence is something that is reflected necessarily in what the jury found to be a verdict, why does the judge have to engage in any fact finding at all? Why isn't what he does simply an application of the law?
Well, that's a reasonable understanding or interpretation of what happened here.
And that may be, but my question goes beyond that. And the question is there a concession here by the people that what occurred was fact-finding?
As I said, to some extent, I think the trial court did engage in some factual finding. Like there was an intimate relationship between defendant and the victim, that they had a child, that they had a history of domestic violence, the fact that he sent a letter to someone else. He also discussed the content of the letter, that it was coercive, that defendants tried to manipulate the victim into initiating the relationship. I think those are factual findings.
Well, here Mr. Hassel in his brief concedes that it was an intimate relationship. That's not a disputed fact.
Well, that's just part of everything else for the other findings. I mean, the defendant disputed whether he sent or whether the letter, he used the letter as a means of coercing the victim. I think that's the heart or the key or the gist of this, of the claim. He said that he didn't send the letter as a means of coercing the victim. It was just mostly an apology.
If the letter had some different content, something really innocuous, would that have still violated the protection order?
Yes.
So the defendant, for example, as a hypothetical, could have said, my sister's getting married. I know you always liked her. I thought you would want to know. And that would violate the protection order.
Yes, because he couldn't have any content at all.
And so would that have been coercive, that sort of content?
I don't think so. Any other related questions in that sense?
Well, let me ask you a follow-up to that. So when we look at what the jury found and the essential facts to support the jury verdict, so what's reflected in the jury verdict, do you agree with your opposing counsel then that it's the essential elements of violation of a protection order, or was there anything else in the jury verdict that the jury found?
Well, the crime for the defendant was convicted of was just violation of a protection order, which required that the elements were that he knowingly contacted the victim in this case, knowing that there was a protection order in place. There was not a specific element or finding that this involved domestic violence at all. Now, the jury did hear evidence of the, what I call in my brief, triggering event, is the prior domestic violence act that led to the issuance of the protection order in this case. And then, of course, the jury, I think the jury was presented with evidence of the letter, but there was not a specific finding by the jury of domestic violence in this case. So going back to, the legal question of the Blakely error, just to make clear, the people's position is that the habitual domestic violence offender statute does not violate Blakely because a finding of domestic violence alone without the prior convictions does not authorize an enhanced sentence. Stated differently, it is not a but for the domestic violence finding that a defendant is subject to enhanced sentencing. Without the prior convictions, an offender would never be amenable under the statute. And I think that's the reason why in this case there's not a Blakely violation. The different scenario would be if, based on the domestic violence finding, a defendant would be or was subject to the enhanced sentencing alone, but that's not the case. Under no circumstances could an offender be subject to the enhanced sentencing under the statute based on that domestic violence finding alone. And unless you have a question on that, I'm just going to quickly move on the...
Well, let me follow up with that. So I know you rely on that Washington State case, and since your briefing, I don't think you found any other cases, but since your briefing, have you found any other cases one way or the other on that point?
No. I conducted extensive research on domestic violence and findings by the court of the jury in Blakely, and I couldn't find. I only found this Washington case, and I would have to agree with the opposing counsel that it's kind of a little difficult to make sense of it. The black letter law, and this is an 05 case, January 24th, is that the court said that a finding of domestic violence alone does not authorize an exceptional sentence under the applicable Washington statute, and therefore does not impermissibly increase the potential punishment. So, but yes, that's the only case I could find nationwide, and that's what the case held.
All right, well, your opposing counsel said, well, it is an essential fact that would need to be found in order to support enhanced sentencing. Do you agree with that point?
Yes and no, and let me explain. I think it is an essential fact in the sense that without the domestic violence findings, a defendant cannot be sentenced under the statute. But it is not essential in the way that is the only fact, or that is the only fact that subjects a defendant to enhanced sentencing. Because as I said, without the prior conviction, doesn't matter. Doesn't matter if there's a finding of domestic violence. Without the prior convictions, which are legally exempt, a defendant is not going to be subject to the statute. So it cuts both ways. So it is, yes, I say essential in that sense, but it's not essential because it's not a bad for that domestic violence finding alone that a defendant is going to be subject to the statute.
So is your understanding that while the statute itself might not be unconstitutional, there are situations where it can be unconstitutionally applied?
I don't think so, because again, as I said, under those circumstances, is that finding alone going to subject the defendant to the enhanced punishment? Because it requires both. It requires both. That the court finds that the misdemeanor includes an act of domestic violence and that the defendant has three prior convictions.
So how would it work in your view if you have an offense where some fact raises the class of felony and then the defendant is charged as an habitual? Is the fact that the habitual charging would be an ultimate fact that would need to reach the particular range of punishment imposed, does that mean that the jury does not have to make a fact finding under Blakely and Apprendi on the element that raises the class?
Could you repeat the question?
Let's say you have an offense where there's some enhancer that, mm-hmm. that raises the class uh-huh. of felony, mm-hmm. okay? And so ordinarily the jury would have to find that, right? Under Blakely and Apprendi.
If it's, yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and so if you had that same offense mm-hmm. and the defendant was charged as an habitual criminal, does that mean that that takes it out of the Blakely Apprendi scenario in your view?
Well, I guess under Lopez, the court said that if it's a fact that aggravates the sentence and is neither Blakely exempt nor Blakely compliant, it's a finding that has to be made by the jury. But if it's either, and you only need one Blakely exempt or Blakely compliant fact so you only need one, and then the trial court, I guess, can make or can rely on other facts that are neither Blakely compliant nor Blakely exempt. And that way, it doesn't violate Blakely.
All right, let me ask you a twist on that. Suppose that the enhancement, you need to find two facts, and we're not talking about Blakely exempt prior convictions.
Okay.
But if you had to find two different facts in order to enhance the penalty, mm-hmm. are you saying a jury would not need to find either fact because either fact alone would not require enhanced sentencing?
Well, I think that if the fact is Blakely exempt or is Blakely compliant, it doesn't have to be made by the jury. If it's neither, the jury would have to make that finding.
Okay, so let me understand. So let's talk about Blakely compliant,
okay.
which means a jury would need to make the finding. But the enhancement requires two facts to be found.
Okay.
Are you saying that a jury would not need to make the finding of either fact because there needs to be two enhancement facts found?
Oh, so my reading, and I don't know if this is going to answer your question, my reading of Lopez, the court, I think, said that if the trial court, if there's a we're talking aggravated facts. If the trial court relies on one that is either Blakely compliant or Blakely exempt, that's all it requires. It can rely on other facts that are neither. So I don't know if I'm misunderstanding your question, but that's I guess part of the holding in Lopez.
Okay.
Just quickly on the standard review, I think there are cases from this court and also the Supreme Court that held that a Blakely error is subject to review under the constitutional harmless error standard review, and that the proper remedy is to remand for resentencing. And in this case, it would be the court found error. It would be for entry of judgment as a class 1 misdemeanor, extraordinary risk of harm, and also for resentencing under the appropriate range.
All right. Is this case different or the same as Medina then, which found structural error?
Okay. I think Medina is not on point. I mean, Medina does not address a Blakely claim at all. In Medina, what happened is that the jury convicted the defendant of a offense that was less serious than the offense that defendant was ultimately sentenced for. I think it was the jury convicted him of a class 5 accessory to murder, which required an element that was different from the class 4. The sentencing court did not preside over the trial, and he simply looked at the complaint, and the complaint was, and the complaint defendant had been charged with the class 4, and simply looked at the complaint and sentenced defendant as a class 4. So I think the facts are very different. They don't address a Blakely error, and there are specific cases from this court and the Supreme Court saying that a Blakely error is subject to review under the harmless error standard of review. Unless the court has any questions, the people thank this court for its time and attention. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Marlera. Mr. Mueller?
I have 3 points I'd like to make before the case is submitted. The first, in response to your question, Judge Graham, the jury verdict did not reflect finding necessarily that sending the letter was an act of domestic violence. And it is a factual determination whether the letter was intended to coerce or control. And I point you in particular to the language of the domestic violence, habitual domestic violence statute itself, which says the underlying factual basis of which has been found. That, I don't think it could be any clearer than that. That's a factual determination that needs to be made by the court. And I agree with your question, Judge Boris, about the hypothetical. If the content of the letter had been, my sister has passed away, I know you two were close, I thought you might like to know, that's a clear example where the finding that sending the letter amounted to contact in violation of the protection order does not necessarily equal domestic violence in the sense of coercion or control. That's a separate issue the jury has to determine in this case. The next point I'd like to make is about essentiality, I guess, and whether the element, the domestic violence finding, was essential to the punishment. And Judge Lichtenstein, you asked about the case where there are 2 facts that are necessary, perhaps, to impose an aggravated sentence. And I think a good example of that is really kind of any enhanced case. You have, I'll go back to that, assault of an at-risk adult. In that case, you have an assault, which is a misdemeanor normally. If it's an at-risk adult, it becomes a felony. Now, the at-risk adult finding alone didn't expose the person to a class 6 felony conviction. It was the at-risk adult finding plus the mens rea. That's always the case. There's always going to be an extra element, almost always going to be an extra element that the combination of which amounts to an excessive punishment or to an aggravated punishment. And you can't exempt something from the jury trial requirement just because one fact alone didn't expose the defendant to the enhanced punishment.
Mr. Mueller, if we find reversible error, do you agree that the remedy is to remand for sentencing for the class 2 misdemeanor?
If this court agrees with me only on the first issue, yes. I think the jury verdict, there's a unanimous jury verdict on a misdemeanor conviction, and that would be the correct remedy. I think it's the third issue in the brief, which concerns the prior act or res geste evidence. If that was error and prejudicial error by the court to admit that, then the entire judgment of conviction would be reversed. But assuming the court disagrees with me on that position, then yes, the correct remedy, I think, would be to send it back for imposition of the misdemeanor.
And if we agree that the entire judgment is reversed, then would there be a retrial on which charges?
Again, assuming the court agrees there was sufficient evidence of the domestic violence finding, which is the second issue in the brief, then I think the jury could retry on the felony, as long as the domestic violence finding is put to the jury.
And yeah, and then in that event, they could be given a special verdict on the domestic violence and perhaps get a greater punishment?
Not greater than 30 months, probably. I think there would be double jeopardy issues. Or due process
issues.
Well, I mean,
maybe greater than the class 2 misdemeanor.
Yes, I would agree with that. They could retry on the felony. And in fact, the defense counsel in this case submitted a proposed verdict form, which is much like you see in any case where there's a question about a deadly weapon or something. It was not guilty, guilty, and then had the jury check a box. Was this an act of domestic violence? It's not an act of domestic violence. And submitted an accompanying instruction, and that's in the record if you wanted to take a look at it. If there are no other questions, I would ask this court to reverse the judgment.
Thank you, Mr. Mueller. And thanks to both counsel for candid, excellent arguments today. I think they were helpful to the court. The matter is deemed submitted, and you can expect a written opinion to issue in due course.